very simplistic description, but the point is that we often tend to find correlations between totally unrelated items or events. It could take the form of an unlucky suit, the way you started your day, or the last conversation with your boss. The quality of your decisions determines the quality of your result. If your decisions are based on a faulty belief system, then the results will be warped. So remember, the next time you get knocked back, or asked to perform a difficult task, or you have to face a fear, see it for what it is in that moment. Just catch the frisbee. Be a dog. Have you ever noticed that there are some people who seem to have the magic touch? It seems that no matter what they attempt, they achieve success. In more than 20 years of personal development, I have always wondered how that happens. I now believe that it is because they instinctively think like dogs. Sales dogs have four basic mindset disciplines that once integrated can dramatically change the results in all areas of life. With these disciplines, you too can have that magic touch. Are you interested? The first and critical question is, are you willing to truly think like a dog? If your ego can handle it, I'm sure that your bank account will appreciate it, because these mindsets are the reason some dogs can hunt, sell, and others never will. These mindsets are all about how you mentally deal with four critical areas everyone encounters every day. Number one, taking on challenges or adversity, facing the challenge. Number two, responding to a negative experience, trap negative dialogue. Number three, responding to successful endeavor, celebrate all wins. And number four, viewing yourself and others on your team, project the power of your personal intention. The success formula for all four points above takes only minutes to learn and seconds to apply, and is guaranteed to positively affect all areas of your life. Enjoy more sales, more money, better health, peace of mind, and happiness. This is a proven formula, one I've been using for more than 15 years to help organizations make millions of dollars by coaching million-dollar sales dogs, building championship sales dog sled teams, high-performance players, and inspirational leaders. Using these mindsets on a systemic basis has proven to improve sales by 30 to 80%. It's even possible to test some of these mindsets in advance to predict and affect future performance. Number one, face the challenge. Taking on a challenge or facing adversity can be intimidating and is often loaded with anxiety. Most high-performance dogs are able to take on very challenging tasks because of their conditioning and training. For inspiration, they rely on very simple memory banks that tell them that reward follows successful completion of their task. They don't remember the times they failed, unless these moments are linked to punishment or pain. The golden retriever probably doesn't poison her mind with visions of failure. You can tell by her eager expression of pure excitement and enthusiasm that she fully anticipates success. She's going to get that stick. All she can see is the stroke, the treat, the cuddle that lies ahead. She relies on successes of the past while allowing the failures to slip on by. From her past, there are a series of memories of success that can be leveraged to give strength in the present and courage in the future. Basketball legend Michael Jordan talked about how he handled the pressure of always having the ball in his hands at the end of any close game. He said, "I do not try to visualize it or hype myself into it." Instead, he recalls in vivid detail the drama-filled closing seconds of the 1982 NCAA National Championship Finals, when he made a 22-footer from near the baseline to win the championship for North Carolina. He says that when a challenge is imminent, he pictures that moment in 1982 and says to himself, "Okay, I've been here before," calms down, and waits for something positive to emerge. That's from the book Sacred Hoops by Phil Jackson. Even when you haven't succeeded in exactly this situation, search for a similar experience from your past so you can draw confidence and assurance from that event to assist you in the present moment. The summary here is this. The present can create high emotion, which can yield low intelligence, and as a result, sometimes low resourcefulness. Strength can come from the past. You must learn to capture those successes and use them in the present. Number two, trap negative dialogue. The most phenomenal discipline you can implement is learning how to trap the mental dialogue that occurs during adversity. Have you ever seen a dog get depressed about missing the frisbee in front of the other dogs? Have you ever seen a dog give up after one try? Have you ever seen a dog sulk off and sit in the corner and tell himself how stupid he is for dropping the tennis ball? For that matter, have you ever seen a dog actually catch a cat? They've been chasing them for thousands of years, and I doubt if any dog has ever caught the cat. Do they lie on the floor with paws over their head crying about how their life doesn't work? Or do they just find another cat? Adversity is part of life. Getting knocked back is part of the natural testing and feedback process of life. You may burn your tongue on soup a couple of times until you discover it is the right temperature to eat. It's testing. You don't give up eating soup or eat only cold soup for the rest of your life. Dogs keep their energy high and keep bouncing back until they get the response that they want. They don't need a formula because it's in their blood. Sales dogs, on the other hand, need the formula for winning in order to keep their brain from going into meltdown. Here are some keys to keeping your brain in check and concentrating on sales success. First, contrary to many traditional New Age personal development programs, it is critical to know how to externalize the event. That means it is important to attribute the cause of the problem to circumstances outside your total control. In other words, shift the blame away from you. For example, prospects having a bad day, bad timing, bad hair day, information that was unavailable to you, someone else's personal issues. Basically, it's important that you keep your mental house clean of any damaging trash. You can't allow a negative moment to be a reflection of any other part of your life, your business, or your sales cycle. That one prospect rejected your cold call doesn't mean that your whole week is going to be bad. It doesn't mean that your sales cycle is inherently flawed or you're not cut out to be a salesperson. And it doesn't mean that you'll never get your finances in order. That is all crazy big brain thinking. A dog would never dream of making such wild and random correlations. Now hear this. Being responsible does not mean that everything bad that happens to you is caused by you. Making the assumption that you yourself are the sole cause of all negative experiences can be incredibly damaging to you. This doesn't mean that you don't learn from your mistakes. It just means that you don't allow your mistakes to ruin your mental well-being. This ability to deal with and explain adversity can be found in the mindset of every great salesperson, sports player, team coach, and investor. You are responsible for how you respond, what your next action will be, or how you interpret the experience, but not necessarily the cause of the experience itself. It does not matter if your conclusion or interpretation is true. Your mind doesn't know the difference. If you interpret the cause to be you, your energy goes down. If you externalize it, your energy goes up. Remember that sales is a pure energy business, so as long as you keep the energy high, you will recover faster and sell more. Second, tell yourself that the rejection is a specific occurrence and do not let your brain interpret it as having any long-lasting or extended significance. Take it for what it is, that a particular person does not have a particular need for your particular product or service at this particular time. Here is the formula for dealing with a negative situation. Memorize this. Number one, first, a problem occurs. It must be actually happening, like leaving your suit coat at the airport and realizing that you've forgotten it only after the plane has taken off. Or perhaps a prospect tells you that he no longer has need for your product. Number two, as soon as you discover that problem, you'll experience a flash of some sort of emotion. This must act as your alarm bell telling you to be aware of what comes next. Number three, the dialogue in your brain now begins. Number four, within seconds of the dialogue starting, you must override it by asking yourself, What am I saying to myself right now? This question forces your brain to answer, and you then step outside yourself and observe the internal dialogue. Number 5, you must first identify the real emotion. Anger, frustration, disappointment, and so forth. Ask this, what is it that I am feeling right now? Once you have identified the emotion, say the word out loud. Aha, it's frustration. You can shout this out or whisper it depending upon where you are and how you feel. Have fun with it. For example, say it in an Inspector Clouseau accent. Number 6, within about 10 seconds, you can usually recognize that you're using a universal descriptive word such as always, never, every time, all, or every. For example, this always happens to me, or I'm never going to get this. Number 7, upon recognizing this universal word, you should pause, put it in check, smile, and say, there it is. Spotting the word or words is 95% of the battle toward instant recovery. The smile lightens the load and raises your energy. Number 8, you must then mentally correct the universal words with something specific like, this time, or it just so happens that, or it turns out that, or in this case, it didn't work. Number 9, you should then spot the internal directive. I, me, my fault, what is it about me, why me, and so forth. Number 10, smile again and say, there it is. Then find some way to lay blame, justify, or blow it off to logical circumstances. This part can be fun and humorous to do. That guy was in a bad mood today. With a toupee like that, it's no wonder he's having a bad day. The competition was lucky this time. Hey, there's room for all of us. Number 11. Then, based upon whatever you told yourself, quickly create a stack of facts and evidence to justify what you told yourself. Like, I was tired from 24 hours of traveling and a bit burned out when I set down my jacket somewhere in that airport. Or, that guy was nice every other time I talked to him. It was just today that he was a jerk. Number 12. This is the most important step. Ask yourself this question. How do I really want to feel right now? Optimistic, happy, excited, strong, confident, and so forth. Ask the question to yourself and then try to actually get that feeling inside. If you cannot, think of an experience, vision, or episode that will bring a small smile to your face. Once you do that, then hold the feeling for as long as you can. Seconds, minutes, even hours. This will shift the energy all around you. And this is the magic part. Do not ask me why it works. Just do it. I have found that once my emotions or feelings begin to change, everything else does too. For example, I say to myself, I would really rather feel happy right now. I picture a scene of my son Benjamin scoring his first goal at soccer camp and his two little fists raised into the air as he explodes with joy. A smile is on my face. I hold it for a few seconds, anticipating my next present time action, and the process is complete. 13. After all this, you should tell yourself to expect a good thing to happen soon. And then it does. The phone rings and someone from LAX airport security will tell you they found your jacket, or you get a call from a long lost prospect who wants to see you. This whole process I just described takes about 1 minute max. To sum up, if something negative happens, you have to know how to tune in to your internal dialogue, how to trap the little voice in your head and steer it toward award-winning conversation. This technique is critical for generating sales at any level of business. It is critical to having a winning attitude about life. Have fun with adversity. Number 3, celebrate all wins. Responding to success when the wins start happening or when anything positive happens is an important two-step process. First, you have to get to celebrate the win. A physical anchoring of the win with a high five, handshake, clenched fist, or verbal yes are all methods that most of us are familiar with. As a sales dog, I suggest you at least give yourself a pat on the head or release a big howl at the moon. These methods drive the moment deep into your mind, your spirit, and your body for permanent strength. The cementing of that moment builds momentum for the next task. Over the years, I have seen the most phenomenal shifts in people, organizations, and performance as a result of continual acknowledgement and celebration of wins. If you've ever watched sports on TV or even played yourself, you will know and accept that celebration is part of the game. Every time a player scores a point, gains a few yards, does something well, gets a hit, or makes a catch, instinctively the rest of the players give him a high five, a pat on the back, a headbutt, not recommended, or something to acknowledge his contribution. There's no way a player in the NBA can score a basket without getting a high five. That is why they're so achievement-oriented. Of all the techniques, this is probably the most powerful yet least used by adults because adults get embarrassed and think it's childish or unprofessional. Several years ago, I worked with an overseas hotel. It was a good company with several hundred people on staff. Working with the heads of departments, I coached them into the habit of always celebrating wins, not only their wins, but also the wins of their staff. This was not easy because the culture of many Asian regions does not include this kind of celebration. Yet over the months, the new habits began to sink in. This hotel slowly but surely began to see the results as the entire staff overcame their reserved natural habits. The organization became a money-making sales machine. Their combined energy was so high that during the last Asian economic downturn, when most other hotels in the region were operating at 40 to 50% occupancy, this hotel was 90% plus. They banded together and decided that everyone in the hotel was responsible for sales. In fact, the largest account was actually landed by members of the housekeeping department. The successful turnaround was a direct result of the constant acknowledgement and active celebrating of the wins, not to mention the increased morale and general happiness throughout the hotel. You see, we all know how to do this. We did it when we were young, and we do it when we play. As kids, we are born with a natural instinct to persist, to ask, and to have fun doing whatever it is we do. I think we are all born as perfect sales dogs. But when we get told things like, it's rude to ask, or stop being silly, or stop annoying others, or sit down and be quiet, all these things that we do instinctively, like speaking to strangers and shouting at the top of our voices just because we feel like it, are conditioned out of us. I recently met a woman who told me that at her last parent-teacher conference for her 5-year-old daughter, she was told that her daughter was fine in school, but that she had a little bit too much self-esteem. Can you imagine that? As we get scolded, punished, ridiculed, or ignored, we get pushed back into a system of seriousness, especially when it comes to business. Dogs will abandon their bones, their food, and all their playthings for a good scratch behind the ears. They get super excited the more you acknowledge them. Little kids do this too. Nothing has changed just because we are adults. Our brains and spirits are still the same. This technique of celebration is foreign to most people, but second nature to high achievers. It also has to do with trapping the little voice and steering the dialogue in the right direction. And remember, it doesn't matter if what you're saying to yourself is true or not. Your body and mind don't care. Part of this dialogue has to do with how to make the event filter into all areas of your being and own it for yourself. Handling success is the absolute opposite of handling setbacks. If something good happens, such as a prospect agreeing to an appointment or receiving any positive sign from a client, not only should you celebrate it, as I mentioned, but to really build momentum, you have to use it to become a legend in your own lunchtime. Tell yourself that because of this success, your whole week is going to be great. You can see how everything in your life is going to be successful just because of this tiny event. Finally, it is important to internalize it by telling yourself that the success happened because of you. You earned it, you worked for it, you're smart, and you know this stuff. Get the picture? Your energy and momentum will soar, and all sales dogs know that the greater the energy, the greater the next success. You may not be aware of it, but you already know how to do this because you did it with your kids, with your pets, and with yourself in other areas of your life. when your kids were little? Didn't you make a big deal and celebrate all their new accomplishments? If your kid managed to stand even for a split second, didn't you picture future Olympic glory? If you ever played golf, you've done this. Just as your frustration hits its peak and you're ready to toss your pings into the lake, you knock a 9-iron stiff within 3 feet of the cup or nail a 40-foot putt for birdie. What do? You clench your fist and you give it the old Tiger Woods thrust and the frustration evaporates. Imagine if you treated your whole life that way. Your energy and your results would be incredible. The problem is some people, even when they get to a win, want to cut it off at the knees. They sink the putt and say to themselves, I was lucky that time. They make a successful call and say, too bad they aren't all like that. That is the dialogue that drives a spike into the heart of your spirit, your energy, and your results. From now on, be a legend. Here's a big tip for managers. Your pack of sales dogs needs to celebrate their wins too. As a matter of fact, the smarter the breed and the more aggressive the dog, the more you have to bury them in lavish praise to ensure good performance. If neglected, or if only scolded for poor behavior, sales dogs can get mean and nasty and may even turn on you one day. You must celebrate wins early and often to make them great hunters and companions. For some reason, when we get older, go to work, and take on careers, celebration becomes childish. We're actually taught not to sell. We are taught not to ask. We are taught to work hard, be good, color within the lines, and hope that someone will recognize us for our efforts and throw us some scraps. We are told that all good things will come to those that wait. We are taught to accept, not object, to give, not to ask, and to accept our lot in life. We are manipulated and contorted to fit snugly into a ready-made box where we are expected to live quietly until we die. We are judged by our ability to answer questions, not ask them, and God forbid we should ever make a mistake. I believe that everyone has the natural talent to sell. Every child can sell. You can sell. We are all born to sell. Some need more skills than others do. Some need a new attitude about it. Some are already hot on the hunt. The next time your kid pesters you for something, rather than telling him to knock it off, ask him to present you with at least 3 good reasons why you should act on his request. When you see those little eyes glance skyward in the search for solutions, smile to yourself and know that your training in this moment will be preparing him for a life of joy, love, and wealth. That is his birthright and destiny. So celebrate, celebrate, and celebrate some more. And by the way, a dog doesn't need a party or a raise to feel acknowledged or celebrated. A simple clap, pat, stroke, or scratch of the neck will do. So the summary on this is, wins are the most precious commodity you have. Most people have a natural mindset that minimizes them, but that is a killer of enthusiasm and energy. It is critical to learn how to spot the wins, trap them, own them, leverage them, and save them for the next big event. Number 4, project the power of your personal intention. The mastery of this technique is critical to forming a high-power sales team or organization. It is also the secret to reducing stress in the job, creating inspirational leadership, and, most important, obtaining personal wealth. Learning how to project your intention of yourself and others can be the difference between frustration and riches. Let me explain in dog terms. When a dog takes off after a squirrel, a cat, or a ball, it fully intends to get it. There is no trying involved. It's just doing. When they go up to you with their tongue hanging out and drool dripping on your shoes, they fully intend for you to pet them. No question about it. That is their intention. If you, as a sales dog, think that you're going to charm everyone you meet, you'll probably do better than you think. However, if you think you're going to be a nuisance to the prospect or that you're going to be boring, you probably will be. That is intention. Learning how to project your intentions and expectations can be the difference between wealth and frustration. In other words, what do you expect the response to be from your next presentation? Will they think you're a rookie? Will they think that you are truly there to help them find new solutions? Will they like you, hate you, think you're a nuisance? What do you think they will think? What is your intention? Research shows us that whatever you believe the response is going to be will help to predetermine what the real response is. If you think that you're going to be a pest by making a sales call, you may very well be right. If, however, you think you're going to be a welcome messenger of critical information, you may be right as well. Your mindset helps to predetermine the results. When my son Benjamin was 4 years old, he had a dilemma. We were in Singapore during one of our overseas trips, and we were staying in a serviced apartment complex in the city. We have stayed there many times because it's a great location and a big swimming pool, and there are always lots of kids for Ben to play with at the time. This place also had a game room with a pool table. Ben loved to play pool by rolling the balls without using the stick. The pool table required 2 $1 Singapore coins. Ben knew this. On this day, he had earned his $2 by setting and clearing the table and was excited about playing pool later. Before going down to the pool room, we went down to the swimming pool to catch some sun and a little exercise. In typical sales dog style, Ben spotted the soda machine and went for it and bought a Sprite and a Coke. Happy with his purchases, he came back to Eileen and me with his goods. We explained to him that he had just spent his pool table money on the drinks. After a convoluted discussion that only a parent can understand, he was faced with the dilemma of two drinks that were now not nearly as desirable as his beloved pool table. A few moments later, I heard a loud pounding sound. It was Ben trying to shove the cans of drink back into the machine in hopes of getting his money back. After calming him down a bit, we made him realize that his only option was to somehow exchange the drinks for money. The light went on and you could see his little blue eyes survey his territory with laser-like precision. Young couple, poolside, lock and load. They had no chance. I do not know to this day if they even spoke English. He raced over to them, set the cans down, and began his pitch. I could not hear anything as he was too far away, but I watched in amazement. They obviously understood that he was offering the cans and that he wanted money in exchange. And judging from his gestures, I think he was also explaining why he needed the money. At first, they shook their heads, but his intention to sell those drinks was undeniable. From the outset, there was no fear, no hesitation, no fear of looking foolish, only the pure intention to get them sold. I watched from a distance and laughed to myself. What a sales dog. Ben had the mindset that he would not be denied. Finally, I watched in proud disbelief as they handed over the cherished coins. Ben even offered to open the cans for them so they could enjoy the drinks immediately. Traces of a true retriever. With coins in hand, he happily skipped back to us to tell us with delight of his accomplishment, leaving two refreshed customers in his wake. That is intention. He had no doubt that he would sell those things. Years later, he is still that way. He will persist and persist and never give up because he knows that sooner or later he will find a chink in our armor and we will agree to his requests. All kids are sales dogs. Bones for managers regarding expectations and intentions of others. What is your expectation of your kennel? Whether you ever communicate it or not, that expectation will show itself somehow or other. Your intention or expectation of the performance ability of others will also partly predetermine their results. If you were to rank each of your sales pups with a number from 1 to 10 in terms of their potential for success, what would those numbers be? If you rank someone with a 3 or 4, you have already in part predisposed him or her to that level. It will show up in your management style and attitude and in their performance results. Unfortunately, this also happened in school for many of us. Teachers hung invisible numbers on our foreheads. What numbers were hung on you? Did you believe them? What number have you hung on yourself? Is it helping or hurting you now? It is a rare sales dog that overachieves what its master expects. Be careful of your intentions and expectations. I had a salesman working for me in the air freight business who most other vendors and associates historically considered to be a pain in the butt. He and I had a great relationship, though, and within a short period, he doubled our volume in one of our toughest and most competitive cities. I kept telling him that I knew he could succeed, even when he was whining and whimpering. After a while, the sulking began to dissipate and was replaced by howling and celebratory yipping as one small win led to another and another. This is a simple example of the effect a good dog trainer can have on a sales dog, an example of a person who, because of his mannerisms, alienated a lot of people. Every job that he held had produced mediocre results. He had drifted from job to job. He was astray. When I took him in, I started his training all over again. We identified him as a yipping chihuahua that drove everyone nuts. We then trained him in the skills of the retriever and the basset hound. His incredible chihuahua mental quickness, coupled with the softness of tone and commitment to service, made him one of the wealthiest salespeople in the territory. We celebrated wins. I acknowledged his efforts. I told him I knew that he could make a ton of money. In other words, I believed in him even though others had taken the newspaper to him. The results spoke for themselves. So here's a summary bone for all managers. Just as your intention affects your sales, your intention for your sales dogs can limit them or urge them to achieve extraordinary success. There is a number that ranks your expectations of others, yourself, and your actions. If it is an expectation of others, it dangles right on that person's forehead and plays a large part in determining that level of performance that is achieved. It is most important that as a dog trainer, you shouldn't be prejudiced by limitations put on your sales dogs by previous managers. Some of the scroungiest mutts make the best hunters because their new master or trainer gave them a whole new expectation and perception of themselves. If you see them as champions, they will invariably rise to meet your expectations and become champions.
An excerpt from Team Code of Honor, The Secrets of Champions in Business and in Life by Blair Singer.
Chapter 1. Why do you need a code of honor? In the absence of rules, people make up their own rules. And some of the biggest collisions in finance, business, and relationships occur because well-meaning people are simply playing by different sets of rules. By the same token, the most miraculous results come from like-minded folks who band together under some invisible bond to achieve greatness. By experience and default, we all formulate our own sets of guidelines, rules, and assumptions. That's natural. But when we start coming together with other people, organizations, and cultures, we sometimes have a tough time figuring out why those guys don't understand, or how they could so blatantly turn their back on our feelings, our way of doing things, and our rules. In most respect, those guys feel the same way about us. Why? Because we assume that certain basic rules are the same. Bad assumption. This book is about revealing the process for eliminating one of the biggest causes for financial loss, frustration, and heartbreak. It is about surrounding yourself with folks who subscribe to the same set of rules and how to establish them so that you can ensure peak performance, fun, and incredible results in all that you do. For about 12 years now, I've actively studied teams, looking at what makes them successful and how they are able to operate at peak performance. And after all this time, I can tell you this. You cannot have a championship team in any facet of your life without a code of honor. Team tip right here. Sometimes the easiest way to avoid upset collisions and disharmony in any group is to take the time to make sure that everyone is playing by the same rules. If you're interested in building a great relationship, whether it's with your business, your community, your family, or even yourself, there have to be rules and standards for the behavior that will ultimately achieve your goals. A code of honor is the physical manifestation of the team's values extended into behavior. It's not enough to have values, because we all do. What's so crucial is knowing how to put physical behavior into practice to reflect those values. Let me illustrate what I mean. When I was in high school in Ohio, I was on the cross-country running team. Typically, any human being of the male sex living in the state of Ohio was expected to play football. But if you could see my size, you'd realize that I was just not built to go up against a 200-pound linebacker, even though I love the game. Cross-country was more my style. What a lot of people don't know about cross-country is that there are typically about 5 to 7 runners per team racing all at the same time. Usually, there are several other teams running at the same time. The only way your team can win is if the whole team finishes relatively close together, close to the front of the pack of runners. In other words, having a superstar who runs ahead of the pack and places first doesn't do the team any good if everyone else is all spread out across the field. Cross country is a low scoring sport, meaning that first place receives a point, second receives 2 points, and so on. The idea is to get the whole team to finish near the front so your team gets the lowest score possible. If we could get 4th, 6th, 7th, and 9th place finishes, then even if another team got a 1st, 2nd, 12th, and 18th, we would still win the meet. So for the entire 2.5-mile race, each of us would push the others on, encouraging, threatening, supporting, and yelling with each gasping breath for air. With muscles burning and body strength faltering, it was as much a race of emotional endurance as it was physical. We pushed each other both on and off the course. If someone was slacking, you can rest assured the rest of the team would be on him quickly to pick it up. It took all that each of us had for us to win. Whatever it took for us to cross that finish line close together, that's what we did. In other words, part of our code was to do whatever it took to support everyone to win. We won most of our cross-country meets, or placed very high, even though we had very few superstar runners. We were a championship team. It was my first experience with teams at the most basic, physical, gut-wrenching level, but the lessons it taught me remain the same today. I have always surrounded myself with people who would push me that way and who would allow me to push them as well. It serves them and it serves me. As a result, I have always been blessed with incredibly great friendships, success, and wealth. I have also observed that it is in the times of pressure, when the stakes are high, that people are transformed. I've never seen a great team that didn't come together without some type of pressure. It could be from competition, from outside influences, or it could be self-induced. We knew in those cross-country meets that every person, every second, every step counted toward a win for our team, and it bound us together. We knew that the success of the team took precedence over our individual goals. No one wanted to let the other ones down. It drove you as hard as the desire to win. We had a code that said we stuck together no matter what. And in those really important moments, we came together and did what we needed to do to be successful. Another team tip. A code of honor brings out the best in every person who subscribes to it. But when pressure increases, sometimes so do emotions. When that happens, intelligence has a tendency to drop. People revert to their base instincts in times of stress, and that's when their true colors come out. Sometimes that's not such a pretty sight. Have you ever said something to someone when you were upset that you wish you had not said a few minutes later? I thought so. That's what I mean about high emotion and low intelligence. I've seen teams that work well together day to day, but when things get tough, they revert to every man for himself. A crisis came along and everyone ran for cover because there was no set of rules to help them see their way through it. Judgments based on heightened emotions became their guide, which may not turn out to be the best choice for all concerned. For example, more than half of all marriages end in divorce. In times of stress, the people involved are unable to negotiate their differences. No common code of honor or set of rules holds them together. It is the same issue in the case of a business partnership dispute that has no rules or guidelines. Both situations can get nasty. It isn't that people don't want to work out their differences. The problem is that without rules and expectations mutually agreed upon up front, they act on instinct, particularly when emotions are running high. Each does what he or she thinks is best based upon his or her feelings at that time. Decisions made in that kind of setting may not be the best ones. Now, I know you've never been under any kind of stress, right? Of course you have. You know that when you're upset, when you're under a deadline, when you're angry at a family member or a coworker, it's impossible to try to negotiate terms. Why? Because you aren't in your right mind. That's why you need a code of honor. You must create, in a sane moment, a set of rules for your team that tell everyone how to operate when the heat is really on. That way, in those moments of high stress, the rules legislate the behavior rather than the emotions. The code is not just a set of guidelines to be used only when it's convenient. These are rules that must be called when breached. The needs, tasks, and problems of a team determine how rigid its code is. The Marine Corps has a code that holds its team together under fire. When bullets are flying, life and death may have to take second place to logic and team play. Repetition of their code and its rules conditions the team to come together as a cohesive, trusting unit rather than just running for individual survival. Having a code of honor doesn't mean that everyone on the team is happy 100% of the time. Sometimes things get messy. A code can cause upset, create confrontation, and even put people on the spot. But ultimately, it protects every member of the team from abuse, neglect, and breaches of ethics. A code of honor brings out the best in every person who subscribes to it. You can never assume that people know the code on their own. It isn't something that's necessarily intuitive. You learn it from others, parents, coaches, leaders, or friends. Someone has to show it to you, and everyone involved must agree to it. This is true of any relationship, be it with your business, your family, or yourself. Any relationship with an interest in its own happiness and success. Currently, about 50% of the gross domestic product of the United States comes from small businesses. And of that, about half of those businesses are sole proprietorships or home-based businesses. I tell you this to emphasize a point. The average person has much more power than you think. The way you conduct your business affects the lives of many others. Here's a team tip. Your code is a reflection of you and will attract those who aspire to the same standards. Your reputation, your income, and your longevity depend upon your consistency of behavior internally and externally. The future of our country is in the hands of those who drive the economy, the markets, our businesses, and our families. That's you. Your significance may seem minuscule, but never doubt your influence on others. Your code is a reflection of you, and it will attract those who aspire to the same standards. How you conduct your business may have a bigger impact than the service you provide. Decide here and now that you will create a code of honor for yourself and for the teams you're a part of. What do you stand for? What code do you publicize to the world? How tight is your team? How happy do you really want to be? My purpose here is to give you steps, motivation, insights to building a great team that will give you and those you touch the wealth, satisfaction, and joy you all deserve. So let's talk about who's on your team. Here's a team drill for you. Number one. Discuss great teams that you've been on. What was it like? What were the rules? How did it feel? Number two, what would be the benefits to having a code for your business? A code for your finances, your health, your family?
Garrett Sutton, Esquire, Rich Dad Advisor on Business Entities and Asset Protection. Personal background and entrepreneur profile. Name, Garrett Sutton. Date of birth, April 15, 1953. Place of birth, Oakland, California. Traditional education, Colorado College, Colorado Springs, Colorado, 1971 to 1973. University of California, Berkeley, California, 1973 to 1975. Degree, BS, Business Administration. Professional Education, Hastings College of the Law, San Francisco, California, 1975 to 1978. Degree, Juris Doctor. Grade point averages, high school, 3.4, college, 3.3. Value of traditional education relative to becoming an entrepreneur. Two classes, marketing at Cal and corporations at Hastings, were very useful. Subject I liked most in school: English, journalism, followed by history. Subject I hated most in school: calculus, two quarters of hell. I still don't know what it tries to measure. First entrepreneurial project: collecting stray golf balls at Lake Tahoe and selling them back to golfers. The key entrepreneurial skill I was not taught in school: the importance of raising money. Why and when I became an entrepreneur and my first major venture. I became an entrepreneur because it seemed like the greatest challenge and because I don't like being told what to do. My first major venture was publishing an entertainment and lifestyle monthly in Santa Rosa, California, called Sonoma Monthly. The publication lasted about 3 years. Best lesson from first business: that I had no idea what I was doing. I needed more staff, more funding, and more staying power. I did not know how to build a brand. I relied on a team that was not as committed as I was. The best lesson in hindsight was to fail fast. What I learned about myself from my Kolbe Index. Please see companion file number 14. I learned that I was a quick start, ready to take risks. I also realized that I was not as strong on the implementation and the follow-through, meaning I needed a strong team effort to accomplish goals. My role in the BI triangle. Within the triad of team leadership and mission, my role is the legal line. My job is to provide legal information on entities and their structure and develop strategies for minimizing liability and personal risk. Skills that are essential for entrepreneurs but not taught in schools. 1. The legal system allows all of us to protect ourselves. Our legal system doesn't automatically and beneficially make the right choices for you, but it does allow you to make such choices to your advantage. The key is in knowing what your choices are, since the school system doesn't teach them. You can operate as a sole proprietor with no protection. The system doesn't teach otherwise. You, like everyone else, can take an extra step and be protected with a corporation or LLC. But without any entrepreneurial education, you wouldn't know to, and how to, take that step. 2. The legal system is based on fairness and justice, and not on overly complicated minutiae. The legal system seems so complicated when you talk to an attorney. But know that while some areas are indeed mind-numbing, statutes written by regulators and lobbyists, others are really not. Attorneys play hide the ball. They keep their clients intentionally in the dark to justify their hours and billing. A basic course on contract law would identify that much of our system is based on the public policy of protecting private property rights. The legal system flows from that great concept. Once you understand that, much of the law makes sense, with the exception of government interference with such rights. Entrepreneurs who perceive the big picture, which is not taught in school, can then hire attorneys to carry out the details. 3. Disputes will occur. Prepare for them. Anytime two or more people come together for a business venture, disputes are certain to arise. This is okay and natural. The key is not allowing such disputes to take down the company. Two 50-50 partners or four 25% each partners may come to a deadlock. Neither side will budge. Each side hires an attorney, and the only parties to win are the attorneys. You are better off discussing and implementing deadlock procedures. One side can win 1 year and the other the next, or 0.1% can be given to a neutral party to be the tiebreaker. While not taught in school, Deadlocks occur in business. You must be ready for them. My most important lesson for entrepreneurs. Get your team together. I can recount several horror stories where entrepreneurs realized too late that they needed professional help. A CPA and attorney need to be on your bench so you can use them when needed. How I learned to raise capital. I learned on my client's dime. The proper way to raise money is with a private placement memorandum, or PPM. I have prepared PPMs for numerous clients. How I learned to overcome fear and failure. By fearing and failing several times. My personal strength. I am willing to put in the time to do my part if the tasks are what I enjoy doing. I enjoy being a team player on a winning team. My personal weakness. I don't do well in partnerships where the others aren't pulling their weight. I need to be part of a team where certain tasks are assigned to other team members. I resent having to do all the work in a team environment. What is the entrepreneurial skill that I teach best? How to use entities, cover your assets, and prepare business plans. What is the entrepreneurial lesson that I teach? Cover your assets. Cover Your Assets by Garrett Sutton, Esquire. You don't need to be a crook to get rich. Crooks break the law. The laws were written to make the rich richer. Robert T. Kiyosaki. Like most, you probably would like to stay out of trouble, right? But do you worry that if you start a business or invest in real estate, you could get into trouble? This is not an unreasonable worry. There are so many laws that not even the best lawyers know all of them. I know that for a fact because I'm a lawyer. I'm the Rich Dad Advisor for corporations, LLCs, and asset protection strategies. I am also general counsel for several companies. I grew up in the San Francisco Bay Area. My dad was a county judge in Oakland, California, and I was raised to respect the legal system. I also learned early on that some people could lose everything because they didn't take the proper steps at the start. I heard horror stories at the dinner table about sole proprietors, nameless of course, being sued and getting wiped out, all for failing to take some simple legal steps toward protection. It left quite an impression. When it was time to go to college, I wanted to get out of state and ski. I somehow managed to get into Colorado College, an excellent small school in Colorado Springs. Their course schedule was the block plan, whereby you would take one course at a time every 3.5 weeks, with half a week off to ski. Unfortunately, I didn't take to the block plan. I am not a quick study. I needed more time for the coursework to sink in. So I transferred to the University of California at Berkeley. This was when Cal was a B-plus school. After years of riots and craziness, parents wouldn't send their kids to Berkeley. That was the window I needed, and I was fortunate to earn a business degree from Cal. Then I crossed the bay to attend Hastings College of the Law, the University of California's law school in San Francisco. After passing the bar exam, I practiced law in San Francisco and Washington, D.C. But I always liked the mountains and Lake Tahoe and skiing, so I moved to Reno, Nevada. It was a great move. I have raised a family here, and Nevada is a great state to set up a corporation or an LLC. I know corporate and asset protection law. But back to our original point, do I know every law? Of course not. There are too many of them. In a typical law library, there are rows and rows of books and books filled with laws, laws, and more laws. But what is more striking is that not knowing every law is no defense. You are expected to follow every law, even if you don't know it exists. It is estimated that each of us unknowingly breaks over 3 laws every day. How do we survive in such an overregulated system? Well, it can be done. Look around you. There are plenty of businesses and real estate investments thriving in today's world. How do they do it? It comes down to one word, proper. They do business the proper way. They follow the law. They work with an attorney to be properly protected. Corporations and LLCs protect against unlimited personal liability. This is a proper first step. There may be more. In some cases, you must work with an attorney who specializes in the business niche you are entering. If you're going into payday lending, you need a specialist in the ever-changing laws of that field. If you are going to provide consulting services and know your specialty well, you may only need an attorney to help set up your LLC or corporation. Whatever your situation, you want to do it the proper way. Doing it right also includes paying your taxes. If you're going to stay small, maybe you cheat the government by taking cash under the table and not reporting it. You probably know people who do this. I won't help such people on principle. Everyone should follow the law. But also, as a practical matter, I can't help cheaters grow their business. If you don't accurately report income, your business appears smaller. This doesn't help when you're trying to get a bank loan to expand your operations. You want to show higher revenues, not lower ones. And presenting improperly lowered revenues doesn't help when you're trying to sell your business. Businesses are sold on multiples of revenues. By cheating the government on taxes, you are cheating yourself out of five times that amount in a business sale. Short-term cheaters are usually punished in the long run. Most importantly, the owner sets the tone for the business. When the owner cheats, they tacitly permit others in the organization to cheat. Businesses lacking integrity rarely survive. Smart entrepreneurs and investors pay their taxes while taking advantage of the proper and legal methods to reduce their taxes. But you say, I don't know all the proper and legal methods. Of course you don't. No one does at the start. They certainly did not teach this in school. To do it properly, you need a team on your side. Others have succeeded before you. With the right team, so can you. The tax laws can be used to your great advantage. An accountant on your team can help with that. A bookkeeper as well can assist you to keep track of things right from the start. You need to pay any employee withholdings properly. Let your bookkeeper handle it. Given all the laws, a lawyer is a key member. Let's talk about all those laws. They apply equally to all of us. Let's look at companion file number 1. If you are an employee, an E in the upper left corner of the cash flow quadrant, the laws on employment benefit you to the detriment of the S's, B's, and I's, or the small business owners on the lower left, and the big business owners and investors on the right side. Employees will always be protected under the law. Of course, there will be cases where employees manipulate the system to their advantage. The S's, B's, and I's will always face this issue. Their only recourse is to stay ethical and accept that a few bad apples will appear along the way. Aside from employment laws, there is a whole other area of laws that are exciting and inspiring to B's and I's. These are the incentives in our tax code and legal system specifically written to benefit risk takers. If you follow what the government wants you to do, you can achieve great success. This is true in every country on earth. What is stopping an E or an S from moving over to the right side of the quadrant? Do the laws force them to stay on the left side? Of course not. The laws apply equally to everyone. As an E or an S, you are free to take advantage of the same incentives offered to B's and I's. There is no person or legal system restricting your movement into these quadrants. The only person stopping you is you. But once again, if you're going to operate on the right side of this quadrant, you need a team. You need the services of professionals, a professional team that is on your side, and a team that will serve your best interests. If you're going to operate in a proper manner, you need to remember the chart found in companion file number 15. Proper equals